8th chapter of Ezekiel. Now, four chapters, 8, 9, 10, and 11. You want a Bible, we have one right here on front. 8, 9, 10, and 11 cover one period. Ezekiel was sitting in his house with the elders of Israel who were meeting together with him. And God took him in a vision. He had a vision. God took him by the hair of his head and transported him back to Jerusalem and showed him the wickedness and the idolatry that were taking place there. Then he also, but the main thing is that God shows him this wickedness of the people. In this vision, God also revealed to him that he was going to destroy the city. But the main thing is the departure of Jehovah from their presence. As you saw in this vision, the chariot of God, the glory of God, was lifted up on the threshold. Then from the threshold over the courtyard, the temple yard, and then finally in the latter part of the 11th chapter, it departed into the under the Mount of Olives on the east of the city. Now the whole of this vision was symbolic, a teaching or a vision of the condition of the people and Jehovah's withdrawal from the city and the city destruction, so that they would know what was going to take place. Now it was not until the close of the latter part of the book that the glory of Jehovah returned unto that. We'll leave that till we get to it. But when the glory of God left, then the thing was left to destruction. I think that that is a splendid foretelling of Jesus leaving the city. You remember the 23rd chapter of the book of Matthew, the last two or three verses, the Lord said, "Your house is left unto you desolate." That is when Jesus Christ withdrew his presence from the temple and the people, then they were left unto the destruction of the Roman Empire. So a great lesson is when God departs, when the time has come that God can no longer tolerate a people and he withdraws his presence or blessings from them, they're always doomed to destruction. Now, the lessons like this are what to me are the great lessons of the Old Testament. Now, seeing God's hand in all the affairs of men, God rules in the kingdom of men, Daniel said. And so as God rules in the kingdom of men, he determines, as Paul said, the appointed seasons and the bounds of the habitation. All of that is in his hand. Well, I think we need to realize that, and I'm sure we do, but we need to keep it before us. Now let's turn to the 8th chapter. "And it came to pass in the 6th year, in the 6th month, in the 5th day of the month, as I sat in my house, and the elders of Judah sat before me, that the hand of the Lord Jehovah fell there upon me." Now, another thing we notice about Ezekiel is how often he numbers, or dates rather, the prophecy that he's making. Some of them never leave it much inclination to when it was. But Ezekiel doesn't. Ezekiel dates so many of these prophecies that if you're interested, you can trace pretty well the development of things as they go on there. But at any rate, this would be this particular 6 year there. That's probably from the time that he began prophesying or the time he came into Babylonian captivity. But now notice, "I sat in my house and the elders of Judah sat before me." Now, they had no synagogue at that time. However, the synagogues arose during this Babylonian period. That's where you have the coming of the rising, the development of the synagogue. But at any rate, at this particular time, they're evidently meeting in his house. Now, these elders and these people, they couldn't understand Ezekiel. They didn't like Ezekiel. They seemingly disdained him in every way they could at first. But nevertheless, they realized that here was the only one to whom they could turn. And so they turned to him. So in the house now, and I noticed while I was sitting there, that that the hand of the Lord Jehovah fell there upon me. Now note here he described the glory. Then I beheld, and lo, a likeness as the appearance of fire. Now note the two things, the likeness of the appearance of fire. Wasn't the literal fire, but it had that likeness or that appearance. And from the appearance of his loins and downward, fire. And from his loins and upward, as the appearance of brightness, as it were glowing metal. Now, in order to really appreciate it, and I try to do that when I study Ezekiel, I try to sit there. You remember back in the third chapter in verse 7, he says there in the King James Version, I sat where they sat for 7 days. That always indicated to me that he was sitting where they sat and were looking at life through their eyes. So he could see it through their eyes before he began prophesying. American Standard places it just a little different from that. But now then, I like to sit where he sits and try to see what's going on through his eyes. Now, if you just try to picture that, here these, I don't know how many, but these elders were sitting there before him, and here in his vision now, he sees this being as a fire, as molten metal up here, and fire running up and down back here. And now then he reaches forth and takes him by the lock of his hair, and then you see him floating through the air, transporting him over to Jerusalem. Now there are some writers, or some, I don't know how to call them scholars or not, some Bible students, who think that he was actually in Jerusalem. No. No, he said it was a vision. Now watch what he says now, that we may notice what actually takes place. And he put forth the form of a hand. Now notice it's the form of it. He used all these words, the appearance, or as, and form. He uses that, that we may understand that this is not something physical taking place. Not something literal taking place. It's a literal vision. And literally, in the vision, he's literally transported, but not in person. See? See what the difference in all of that? The form of a hand, and took me by a lock of my head, and the Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven, and brought me in the vision of God to Jerusalem. So he's using every word he can to let us know that it's a vision in spirit, and what he sees is in the vision. There's not anything literal about it, except it's a literal vision. It's a literal vision. It's not a physical action. And to the door of the gate of the inner court that looked toward the north, there was the seat of the image of jealousy, which provoked to jealousy. Well, I described that. Now, Manasseh, when he was king, he built an image of Asherah, or of Asherah, and set it there to the north. That's probably what he's talking about. And it was that which provoked God to jealousy. Now, God's jealousy, and God's spoken of it being jealous so often. Jealousy is that fear or that attitude or disposition developed by the fear of being supplanted in the favor of another. Now, a woman, when she sees her husband begin to carry on with another woman, he becomes jealous. Well, what is that jealousy? It's the fear or the apprehension of being supplanted in the affections of his wife by another person. Same thing when a man sees his wife beginning to carry on a flirtation with somebody else, or the woman with her husband, and either way you want to take it. Well, then jealousy is that apprehension of being supplanted in the affections, in one's affection, by somebody else. So God's jealousy is that apprehension or that dislike of being supplanted in the favor of his people by an idol. The idea of an individual substituting an idol, something he makes with his own hands or somebody else makes and he buys with money, makes him let that take the place of God. Well, now this female goddess here that Manasseh set up there, well, they began, I guess, to think about this as the wife of Jehovah, whereas God's wife was the nation. The nation was his wife, according to Hosea, and the individuals are the children of God in that. You get that in Hosea, the first two chapters. That makes that very clear. All right, so according to the appearance that I saw in the paint, now notice further, and I beheld the glory of the God of Israel was there. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there, according to the appearance that I saw in the plain. All right, now what you saw back in chapter 1, that revelation of God there that he saw there, the glory of God, now then he sees it back in Jerusalem. All right, so what's the teaching there? That God can be anywhere at all times. He's not limited nor restricted to Jerusalem. He is not limited nor restricted to a Babylon. He can know what's going on in Babylon. He knows what's going on here. So what he sees in both is the appearance of the glory of Jehovah. Something that impressed him with the glory of God. So this is what he sees. So here the first thing, jealousy, this image of jealousy here that he sees. There are four things that he sees here, and first is the image here of jealousy here, that which aroused him regard to jealousy and apprehension and to wrath, really, because of that. All right? Then said he unto me, Son of man, lift up thine eyes now, the way toward the north. So I lifted up mine eyes the way toward the north, and behold, northward of the gate of the altar, the image of jealousy in the entry. Right, so here then, there was an east gate, and here's a north gate here, and over there is where they placed this image of jealousy. Now, I don't know whether it was still out. I believe it was destroyed by Josiah. It was destroyed by Josiah. But he's seeing in a vision now that which the people have taken in their hearts. Now, when he gets back in chapter 14 and 3, he says, Son of man, they have taken their idols into their hearts. So what God is showing him here now, in this vision here, what he sees in Jerusalem, is that which they have taken into their hearts instead of God. Well, a man can do that with money. He can do that with pleasure. He can do that with whatever it might be, physical gratification. Whatever he takes into his heart, instead of God, becomes an idol to that individual. And we'll learn that when we come to the 14th chapter there. But anyway, this describes now what God saw there and at that time. Now let's look a little further here. And he goes on to say here, and he said unto me, Son of man, seest thou what they do, even the great abominations that the house of Israel do commit here, that I should go far off from my sanctuary? But thou shalt again see yet more great abomination, other great abomination. I kind of regret. So now notice. Now notice, see what they're doing now. He wants him to see that. And what they're doing, the abomination that they're committing here. And now God said that I should go far off from my sanctuary. So this is the introduction to the fact now that he's going to show Ezekiel his leaving the sanctuary. God's going to leave the temple, going to withdraw from it, and leave it for destruction there when he withdraws. But now notice that thought there, that I should go far off from my sanctuary, but that I shall again see other great abominations. So that's the first one. In the hearts of the people now, the tombs there, hear those pictures all around there. Well, I think it was something like that when he dug in there. Now, here were the pictures of the idols, all that, but digging into this indicates that he gets inside of the hearts of those people now in this vision and really sees what's going on there. Now, who are these fellows that are doing this? Now, look a little further here. All right, go in and see. So I went in and saw, and behold, every form of creeping things and abominable beasts and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed upon the wall round about. And there stood before them 70 men of the elders of Israel, of the house of Israel, and in the midst of them stood Jaazaniah, the son of Shaphan, every man with a censer in his hand, and the odor of the cloud of incense went up. All right, now when I get in here, 70 elders of the, that represent the leaders of the people now. And here was Jaazaniah, the promoter of the whole thing. That's all I know about him. I don't think he's ever mentioned this one. He has some others by that name, but he's the only one that here at this time that I know of. But anyway, now you get in. Now here, they've got the censer in their hand. What are they doing? They're burning incense to all these images here that they've painted on the walls here. So here they are. They're worshiping these, and the odor of the incense filled the building. Right, what's the meaning of all this? The meaning is that here these elders represent the people, and here they are worshiping, burning incense to these idols, because the idols are taken into their heart. So here when we dig in and see what's going on in the hearts of these people, these leaders, who represent the people there. Well, that's about now. When we get through, we're going to see why God is going to destroy the city. Why is he going to destroy it? See, that's the thing that puzzles these people. Well, we're the people of God. The Jews have always rested in the fact that they were descendants of Abraham, the friend of God. They've been circumcised, and therefore they belong to God through Abraham. Now then, they have the law. We're going to study that in our next lesson from Romans, the 3rd chapter. That because they had the law and circumcision, why they thought they were almost immune to anything else that God would do to them. Well, that's the way the Jews felt back yonder. All right? Keep this lesson in mind when we come to the 3rd chapter. I mean, our lesson after a while, the 2nd lesson. We're moving on now to verse 12. Then said he unto me, Son of man, hast thou seen what the elders of the house of Israel do in the dark? Every man in his chambers of imagery. So here he's describing what every man is doing in the dark, thinking he's worshiping them, and God doesn't see. God isn't looking. God doesn't know about that. For they say, Jehovah seeth us not. Jehovah hath forsaken the land. Now since God has left us, and we're left here, God doesn't see it. So now what do? We worship these idols. We turn to something else. Well, when people get the idea, well, God no longer cares and not interested, what do? They go some other direction. They go some other way. All right? They've forsaken the land. He said also unto me, thou shalt again see yet other great abominations, which they do. All right? So here then are the elders. Here's the image of jealousy. Here are the elders now worshiping idols. Worship and idolatry, in the hearts of the leaders here, the elders. All right, so we see that. Now he's going to show us something else. There are 4 things he's going to show him here before he gets through. But then another one, the 5th, will be destruction. So he moves on. Then he brought me to the door of the gate of Jehovah's house, which was toward the north. And behold, there sat the women weeping for Tammuz. Now Tammuz was a nature god. Here it rises in the spring and it goes down in the fall there. And it was sort of the god of love. And so here now are the women, and they are weeping for this god here, because now then he is, time has come that he's vanishing here in the winter of that time there. So it's a nature god. And you see how here the nature, the spring comes, and here the resurrection, fall, things die and go back again. So now then this Tammuz, you're the god of love to them and all that. We're weeping here for Tammuz here. Two M's in there, aren't there? Just one. I'm not the best speller in the world, that's okay. There are 2 of them. All right, and Tammuz. Then said he unto me, thou shalt see, O son of man, thou shalt see yet greater abomination than these. All right, now here's the image of jealousy. Here are the elders worshiping these idols in secret places, back within their own hearts and in their secret places here. Here are the women, they're openly weeping for Tammuz, hence worshiping Tammuz, this particular god, nature god here. I've loved Adonis of other nations. Right? And he brought me into the inner court of Jehovah's house. Now let's try to follow me if we can here we're moving around in this great magnificent building here, moving around from place to place. Now they brought me into the inner court of Jehovah's house, and behold, at the door of the temple of Jehovah, between the porch and the altar, were round about 25 men, with their backs toward the temple of Jehovah, and their faces toward the east, and they were worshiping the sun toward the east. All right, now here then are 25. There were 25 men, and they were worshiping the sun. All right, now here the sun, probably the sun god of Babylon. And now notice here is the temple of God, and here's the altar and the door of the temple. And that back is toward the, which way is east here? I guess, but it doesn't say this is east. All right, here's that. The back then is toward God, and they're looking toward the sun, worshiping the sun. They turn their back on God and worshiping the sun here, and hence the sun god of the Babylonians there. Well, this group being carried into Babylon, so I guess they assumed that the god of Babylon was stronger than their god, therefore we worship him. And they don't realize that because of their sins and not the weakness of God that these things have happened. Right now, verse 17. Then he said unto me, hast thou seen this, O son of man? There's a hole here that everything has been brought forth and everything that he's shown him. Is it a light thing to the house of Judah that they commit the abominations which they commit here? For they have filled the land with violence and have turned again to provoke me to anger. And lo, they put the branch... they put the branch to their nose. Nobody knows for sure what that means, but it was some kind of an irreverent sign or an immoral sign of some kind. I guess like we say, you thumb your nose at a fellow, and something of that nature. But this idea of putting a branch to the nose, no, the scholars have never found anything that indicates exactly what that meant. All of them know that it indicates here an attitude of disrespect toward God, of thumbing your nose at God, telling God, we don't know you, we don't need you, we'll make it without it, we've set up our own gods here. But at any rate, the whole thing was that of belittling or again, a God in their thinking and all that. But now, here are four things now that God shows him here in all of this, these four things. Now, he's going to move on from that in the next chapter now to impending judgment. Now here is why the judgment must come. The people have completely left God out of their thinking, and they've turned to idols and those things. So now in the ninth chapter, you have here the coming judgment when God leaves the city and the judgment is going to come. Then he cried in mine ears with a loud voice, saying, call ye again. Cause ye them that have charge over the city to draw near, every man with his destroying weapon in his hand. And who really was over the city at that time? Really, Babylon was. Babylon now had taken control of the city. Nebuchadnezzar had set up Zedekiah as a puppet king over the city there. So he says here, when you say these to draw near with a weapon in his hand, that would be the symbolic of the army of Babylon, the generals, the leaders of Babylon, who would come. And behold, six men came from the way of the upper gate, which lies toward the north. Well, that's the direction from which the Babylonians came, because although they were northeast, they had to go up north and then come down, come west and then come down around the desert there. Every man with a slaughter weapon in his hand, and one man in the midst of them, clothed in linen, with a writer's ink horn by his side, or in his belt there. And they went in and stood before the brazen altar. In other words, they're waiting now before the altar. They're waiting for the commandment of God as to what they're going to do, what God's going to use them. Right? Now here then is what he sees. Here's the idolatry that Ezekiel saw. Now then, where's the idol? Now here is in destruction force. There are six men with their weapons here, and one with an inkhorn in his belt. Right, now let's see what these are to do, what their function is. And the glory of the God of Israel was gone up from the cherub, whereupon it was, to the threshold of the house. Now notice, there's a gradual departure. Now that was introduced a while ago, that he would do that here. What was going to happen here as that he would, the Holy Ghost, would ultimately leave. Now here it's up to the threshold. There was no longer it within in the temple there. He's now on the threshold of it, gradually taking his departure. We'll come back to that in a few moments in verse 4. verse 4. And it was gone up from the cherub whereupon it was there, the threshold, and he called to the man clothed in linen, who had the writer's inkhorn by his side. And Jehovah said, and go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry over all the abominations that are done in the midst thereof. All right, now here's the man of the inkhorn. What is his function? His function is to put a mark to designate the individuals who are concerned over what's taking place, who are weeping over it. Now they are concerned about this matter. They're the ones who are still holding to a faith in God. They're concerned about what's taking place. They're weeping over it. Now notice what he says further. And cry over all the abominations that are done in the midst thereof. And to the others he said in my hearing, go ye through the city after him and smite. Let not your eyes spare, neither have ye pity. Slay utterly the old man, the young man, and the virgin, and little children and women, but come not near any man upon whom is the mark. All right? And begin at my sanctuary. All right, so now then, what's the order here? Here, these individuals now that we are concerned, now these individuals who have slain every individual that does not have this mark. Well, that reminds us, and I think Revelation, it's my interpretation of Revelation, rests largely upon that. You remember that back then, the seventh chapter, where here the individual had the sign of God on their, and the Son on their forehead. All right? These were spared. These belonged to God. Right here, back here, these have this mark or sign here. They're the ones that are concerned about these matters. And so God says, spare them. I think there were so few of them that there weren't many spared the time got through them. But at any rate, so here is another thing now that Ezekiel emphasizes. I mentioned this before, that Ezekiel emphasizes the individual. Now, we'll come to the 18th chapter and the 33rd chapter. Those two chapters give special emphasis to the individual. Now, the earlier prophets, they were more concerned with the nation as a whole. They would talk about the nation and the nation. When you come to Ezekiel, the nation's doomed. The thing now is, God's concern now is the individual. So you mark these, and the individual who is concerned, I'm going to spare him. The rest of them are going to be destroyed. So this is, this vision, this part of the vision, is emphasizing the fact that because of this idolatry and wickedness among them, God's going to destroy Jerusalem. But he is going to be concerned with that individual who is concerned about the condition. Now, I think God will always follow that same pattern. Now, I may suffer with the nation when a judgment befalls it. I'm still around, or you're still around. We're going to suffer with it. But God will be conscious of us, be concerned with us, and though I may perish in it, God still, I'm his child, and he's going to look after me and take me home to be with him. And so this is a lesson that God is teaching back yonder. In fact, the more I study the Bible, Old and New Testament, more I realize that God is the same always. And every principle he acts by, I've already believed that, that the principle don't change. But I'm more and more coming to see the principles in operation in the Old and New Testament and seeing that there's no difference in them. Same principle. God always acts by the same principle. So this is a thing that I think sometimes if people study the Bible forget, they think, no, the Old Testament, God acted by certain principles, New Testament, a different principle, no such thing. Principle don't change. Now, the law or the covenant under which God operates may change, but the principles never change. They'll always be the same. So we see that. That's one of the things we're learning as we study the Old Testament prophets. Well, it moves on from that now. And smite these others, he said here in this, and begin my sanctuary. Begin with the old men and that were there before the house. Now, maybe that'll help us to understand the passage in 1 Peter. When God says there, and begin with my people here. In other words, God's going to try and test us, whether we're genuine. That's where the testing and trying is going to begin. Then beyond that, there'll be the destruction of those individuals beyond that. But if God tests and tries and judges, he begins with his own people trying and testing them. And if I prove genuine, go look after me. If I don't, I'm going to the crowd. I'll take me right along with the crowd. That's where he acted back on. Now verse 7. And he said unto them, defile the house and fill the courts with a swinging. Go ye forth. That's to the six now. I defile the house with a swinging. Remember that a person was never to be slain within the courtyard, that it ought to be taken without. But now then God says, begin my temple, begin my defile the thing. I've left it. I'm leaving it. So when I leave it, it's simply left for destruction of defilement. All he moves on. And they went forth and smote in the city. And it came to pass, when they were smiting, and I was left, that I fell upon my face and cried and said, Ah, Lord Jehovah, wilt thou destroy all the residue of Israel in thy pouring out of thy wrath upon Jerusalem? In the vision now, he sees himself falling before God and pleading with God, will you destroy the whole of them in this? They might not have liked old Ezekiel over there in the Babylon, and they didn't at first. They looked down upon him, kind of sneered at him. He stayed right in there and kept fighting. After Jerusalem fell, then they came around to listen to him. Said, he sings a pretty good song. Let's listen to him. So he won that as it goes on toward the end, after the fall of Jerusalem. But now then, here, but whether liked him or not, he was praying for his people. He was concerned. What he was suffering was for them. A lesson I've a long time ago learned is that every inch or foot of moral and spiritual progress is always made at the price of vicarious suffering. The innocent suffering for the guilty. Look at your prophets in the Old Testament. Here, these men were not guilty of they were serving how they treated. They were despised, they were beaten, they were run, old Jeremiah put down in a well. I don't know what's true or not. But tradition had that Isaiah was sawed in two with a wooden saw. Now, whether that was so or not, I don't know. I know that Hebrews asked that some of them were sawed over there. Some think that was Isaiah, but we don't have any idea. I don't go much on tradition. But anyway, the point is, here was Isaiah, what he suffered, they wouldn't listen to him. Here was Jeremiah, here was Ezekiel, here was Amos, they wanted to run him out there. All of these men, they were suffering for the cause of others. Come to Jesus Christ, the supreme example. Here is the innocent suffering for the guilty. Now how's that gospel going to be carried out? Paul said in the Colossians letter, the first chapter there, that he says, I rejoice in my suffering for your sake, and fill up on my part that which is lacking of the affliction of Christ in my flesh for his body's sake, which is the church. What does Paul mean by that? Jesus Christ had done all he could do. He had paid the price, he had suffered for our sins. But when he died and went back to heaven, He left it in the hands of the apostles. Then he chose Paul, laid on him the responsibility of carrying that gospel to the world. Think of what Paul suffered vicariously, the innocent for the guilty, to carry the gospel to him. Now, since Paul and the apostles are dead, upon whom does that responsibility fall now? Upon us, every one of us. And I've said so many times, in reaching the world, we're not paying the price. And the same thing true of our brethren. And so you see, it's all the progress is made at the price of vicarious in the next two chapters. It's God. Here. Now that was up on the threshold. Now it's above the threshold. And over here now is over the court. And the court is filled with the glory of Jehovah. All right, now in our next lesson, we will see the glory of Jehovah as it departs, goes over to the east there, to the mount on the east there, and does not return, we'll see, until toward the close of the book, when the glory of Jehovah returns. But I really think it'll be in the new temple that's going to be built, when the glory of Jehovah will return from where it went. But this will be an interesting thing for us to look at when we come to it here. And the sound of the wings of the cherubim was heard even to the outer court as the voice of his angels elect upon them day and night, give long suffering to all, God will avenge. Now as you turn, hear the prayer, praying unto God for an avenging of that which is wrong. God will take vengeance for it, let him do it. Now in Revelation, the 8th chapter, yeah, I think that's right, in the 8th chapter here, when you see this throne of God here, and now here are the prayers that come up under God's throne. And he takes fire from off the altar and casts it upon the earth. That resulted thunders and lightnings and an earthquake. All right, now here the prayers go up. Now from Luke 18, here's the prayers going up. Now in Revelation 8, here the prayers come before the throne of God. God answers those prayers by taking fire off the altar, casting it upon the earth there. And the thunders and the lightning, the earthquake, symbolize judgment. So the judgment comes from God in response to the prayers of the righteous. Well, now you see a similar picture back there in Ezekiel. In this chapter that we're studying here, well, now, here the righteous are taken care of. The judgment comes from the throne of God as the fire scattered over the city. Same thing is still true. Revelation 8 there. Here the prayers go up. Fire is taken off the altar, cast upon the earth. That results then, the thunder and the lightning, the judgment of God in response to prayer. So, all the way through Old and New Testament, God cares for his own. But the wicked are going to be punished, but the punishment comes from the throne of God. It emanates from him, don't you? God's the one that does that. So, as I said last Sunday, I've said many times, and we'll look at these judgments throughout the world here. Where are they coming from? They're coming from God. They're God's judgment, divine judgment. When judgment befalls this country, where will it come? It come from God. Now, when I have a problem, instead of taking that in my own hands, which we like to do, we got a little fellow somewhere that's down in Florida. He calls us about 14 times a day. There's a ring one time, hangs up. But I would like, human nature, I would like to smear his nose all over his face. That's not God's way, and that can't be my way. Eventually, God takes care of it. Now, if there's an aggravation, it's all there to it. But leave it with him. Now, that's a good lesson we're all trying to learn. Hard to learn, but it's a good one to learn. We'll take the rest of that. We'll take the rest of the 10th chapter, 11th chapter, next time. Christ is excused.